This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. So here's the question we're going to take up this afternoon in this portion of the program. What's it like to be a doctor? That's the question we take up in this portion of the program. Our guest is pediatrician and writer Dr. Perry Klass. Dr. Klass's new book, Treatment Kind and Fair, Letters to a Young Doctor, was written while her oldest son, Orlando, was applying to medical school. Orlando Klass, by the way, was born while his mother was in medical school. Treatment Kind and Fair is a book for doctors, aspiring doctors, and those of us who are always on the other side of the stethoscope. Perry Klass says with this book, she wants to help readers understand what it feels like to be a doctor, to, in her words, do the everyday job of it. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for Dr. Klass this afternoon. You can join us with your questions and comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. Dr. Perry Klass is a practicing pediatrician, the author of fiction and nonfiction, and a prize-winning journalist. She is also a professor of journalism and pediatrics at New York University. Her recent books include Every Mother is a Daughter, which she wrote with her mother, Sheila Solomon Klass, and Quirky Kids, Understanding and Helping Your Child Who Doesn't Fit In, which she wrote with Dr. Eileen Costello. Her fiction includes the novel The Mystery of Breathing and the short story collection I Am Having an Adventure. Her new book, Treatment Kind and Fair, Letters to a Young Doctor, is published by Basic Books. Again, the phone number is in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Klass, welcome back to the program. So nice to talk with you again.
It's very nice to be here.
Tell us about the book's title and how you chose it.
Well, Treatment Kind and Fair is actually a line from a poem, which is actually, believe it or not, about being kind to frogs. But the line resonated both because it made me think about treatment in the sense that doctors treat patients and the kind of treatment we all hope for when we're sick, but also since I was writing it to my son, and I was thinking about how medical school and the medical world would treat him and the way the way it can be so hard and the way it can be so fascinating and the way wanting him to love it and to struggle, because I think that's only fair, but not to suffer, hoping that he would get treatment that was both kind and fair from the system and learn how to treat patients in a way that would seem both kind and fair.
And maybe as patients, as we read this book, maybe we'll be kind and fair to our doctors.
Well, that would be nice.
Yeah. How did your son tell you that he was going to apply for medical school?
Well, I had known that he was interested because he was, you know, when he was in college, he was pre-med and he was taking all those courses. But to tell you the truth, I was always very self-conscious about not pushing him because I went to medical school with so many people who were not allowed to consider alternative careers because they were the children of doctors and they were absolutely obliged in their parents' eyes to go to medicine, to go into medicine. And some of them loved it there, but some of them spent a lot of time wondering what might have become of them if they'd gone in another direction. So I didn't want to be one of those parents. I wanted my son to, that I felt like I had the luxury of choosing medicine and then pediatrics out of everything that the great wide world had to offer. And that, you know, whether when the going got tough for me, it was clear that it was all my idea. and I wanted it to be all his idea. So that kind of made me into somebody who pushed a little in the other direction. Hmm. Are you sure you're not more, you know, are you sure you don't want to go into research? Are you sure you don't want to try this? Are you sure, you know, don't be in too much of a hurry? And I think the good thing about that was that it put him in the position of saying, no, this is what I want. This is what I know I want.
And why does he want that?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, one of the things that I write about in the book is, of course, I take it a little as in a flattering light. I take, you know, as a mother, I probably, as any parent would, something in me wants to say, oh, I must have looked like I was having an interesting time. You must have thought our household, contrary to my memories, you must have thought things ran smoothly. But I don't know that it's really about that at all. That is to say, I think in a way, we take what our parents do for granted. That's just what they do. I think he found his way in high school to biology, uh-huh. and then in college to some of the sort of more complicated biology, to genetics and molecular biology and things that, to be honest, I don't know very well, and found it fascinating. And then I think there was a way in which you look around, he probably looked around at me and at my friends and my colleagues whom he knows, and the promise that medicine makes you as a career is if you put in the time and effort to join this career, this is what you will do to make your living. You will actually use this training, and you'll use it every day, and life will stay very interesting.
Yeah, so an interesting life. One of the things you say in Treatment Kind and Fair is you offer this advice to an aspiring doctor, to your son, in this letter. You say, for heaven's sakes, when you write that essay, when you're applying to medical school, don't say you want to become a doctor to help people. That's a given. So how do people answer that question? I imagine there's a range of responses to that question.
Well, the reason I say that is, as someone who's read a lot of those essays, and I was a pre-med tutor for a while when I was in medical school, and I helped people who are applying, and now I sometimes read applications, it's kind of like we believe you want to help people. That doesn't actually tell us anything about you. That doesn't mm-hmm. distinguish you in any way from the other 500 people who want to help people. You have to make it specific. And there are so many ways to make it specific. It's better to write clearly and honestly and passionately about the moment you first understood the gene, or the moment that you saw something happen to a family member in the it just has to be specific. You have to convey something concrete. You have to convey the passion. You have to convey something that when I put the essay down, I'll remember, oh, that's the kid who wrote about the year that his grandmother was so sick and his family practically lived in the hospital. I'll always remember him and his grandmother. So it's not that I don't believe that people really do want to help people. Mm-hmm. Sure, it's one of the reasons you go into medicine, not just that you'll get to use these skills in this training, but you'll get to do something every day which changes other people's lives and changes them in a good way. It's not the only profession in which that's true, but it's certainly true. But once you've said that, we still don't know who you are or how you think or what moves you deeply.
So you're looking for passion in what it is that has captured your heart, I suppose, and your mind about medicine.
Oh, well, I think that's very true, what you just said. I think ideally in that essay, you're showing us that your heart is in it, and that you're a person with heart, but also that you want to go at it in a way which engages your mind and your brain. And I think probably the most effective essay that you can write going into medical school takes you that distance, says, here is what I felt when I first understood something or other about the cell or about the virus or about the gene, and this is how I felt when I understood mm-hmm. what it could mean in the lives of people who are sick or are suffering.
Yeah. For you, in your going back to when you were decided that you would like to go into medicine, what was it for you?
Oh, mine is a sort of a strange one. I was very interested in parasites and parasitic organisms. I was actually a graduate student in in biology studying the life cycles of parasitic organisms, and I thought they were totally fascinating. I still do. I do infectious diseases. But I realized that instead of the people who did kind of the pure science of it, I was drawn to the people who were doing it from the medical point of view. And yes, they were engaged with this fascinating biology and these fascinating organisms, but there was another whole side to their story, which was about, oh, villages stricken by river blindness in Africa or Central America, or people whose lives were being destroyed because they got in the way of these parasite host cycles, and where you could change things around and you could make a difference in their lives.
Hmm. What makes a doctor a good doctor?
Well, that's a really good and interesting question, and it probably has a lot of dimensions to it, because one thing I have to say as a pediatrician is that there are people for whom I'm a good doctor and people for whom I'm probably not their first choice. I'm always interested. Hmm. I've worked with colleagues who, you know, I've felt that, you know, you would not be my choice if I were picking someone to take my children to, and those same doctors have devoted patients who find their style and their approach absolutely perfect. So some of it is fit. Some of it is finding the person who deals with you and talks to you in a way that works for the very, very personal stuff of the doctor-patient relationship. But, I mean, I think there are some general things, because we know what people complain about. Obviously, there's medical skill and keeping up to date and, you know, really looking and listening carefully, not making up your mind in advance about patients, but listening to people's stories, listening carefully, looking again, taking their concerns seriously. I think that probably the easiest way to be a bad doctor is to start sliding toward the one-size-fits-all model. You know, you must be another one of those.
Hmm. There is a chapter in the book. It's the second chapter, and it's a very important one, and it comes early in the book, Asking Questions Crossing Borders, and it's about listening. It's about learning to listen, and learning to listen to people whose situation may be difficult or foreign, and to the best of one's ability, trying to get a little bit inside of this individual's life. Is this something that is taught? Can it be taught?
Well, we try to teach it. And, of course, those of us who are teaching it would have to say we're still learning it ourselves. I don't know that, you know, most of us ever get to the point. In fact, one thing which has occurred to me is that what you do, talking to different people, drawing them out, is actually, maybe we shouldn't have doctors teaching medical students. Maybe we should have people who are better than we are at engaging in conversations with a whole range of people and actually drawing them out and getting them to talk about what's most important to them.
Mm. Terry Gross and Seymour Hersh.
Yeah, well, what do you think? I mean, how do you learn to do it well?
You do it, I guess. And I think you have to come to it with an interest in the person that you're talking with.
Well, I think that's also important because I think when many medical students do it for the first time, they're so terrified, you know, I'm wearing this white coat. When are they going to turn and say, oh, it's all been a mistake, give back the white coat. I have this stethoscope around my neck. What if they know that I don't know how to use it? You know, how can I be the doctor? She looks exactly like my grandmother. Am I really going to tell her to take off her clothes? Mm. All of that. That noise can be so loud in your head that you can forget that your real job is to sit quietly and listen to the patient tell you what's going on with her. You can be so busy worrying that you're going to forget the medical jargon that you don't really concentrate on letting the patient tell you what she's feeling. So we do try to teach it, and there are a bunch of ways that we teach it. Some schools actually use professional patients. Actors or people who've done it before who come in with a story, and then the medical student is sent in to sort of to interview them, and we see how much of the story you come out with, and they're not going to tell you unless you ask. We also, what I write about in the book is what we do at the school where I teach with first-year students is before they've learned really any medicine at all, when they're still in the first semester of their first year, we take them in groups to talk to patients, not about their illnesses or their pathophysiology, but about their lives, about what it's like to be in the hospital, about what it's like to live with various disabilities or other issues. And we try to get them, first of all, I think one of the most important messages, especially for your very polite, sweet-natured medical student, and most of them are that, is people want to talk to you. They want to be asked about themselves. They're not going to get angry at you and chase you out of the room for asking personal questions. Many of them have been sitting there all day in the hospital thinking about their lives or worrying about their families. And if you're polite and you're respectful, they want to talk to you.
Hmm.
And I think that's almost the biggest step to take.
Yeah. There's a wonderful story in the book about a grandmother whose granddaughter was in pediatric intensive care. And she agreed to talk with a group of your students. Tell the audience, our listeners, what that was like. It's an amazing story.
Well, she had a grandchild who had been badly injured, and you know, one of the sort of backstories of pediatrics is that there are these amazing heroic parents and grandparents who basically live in the hospital to be there for a hurt child or a sick child or an injured child. And my thought in asking this woman to talk to the students was that she might give them a sense of this kind of life. But that wasn't what she wanted to do. She agreed to talk. What she wanted to tell them, and she had obviously thought and thought and thought about this since I asked her, she wanted them to be able to picture the child before she was hurt. She wanted that child to live again in the room when she was happy and dancing, and she wanted all of us to see not the child who was now so sick, but the child who had been there before. And the level of her emotion and the level of the emotion that it called up in the students was almost terrifying, but it was also another lesson in what I said. People want to tell you if you want to listen. And one of the mistakes that you make as a medical student is thinking that we call this taking a history. And there's a tendency to believe that it can be done kind of formulaically when you're starting out. You know, somebody says, I had chest pain. Here are the 15 questions you should follow up with. Oh, did it radiate into your neck? Was it sharp or dull? And it's not that those aren't important questions, but if what the person says to you is, and whenever I think about my son, I get chest pain, then maybe that person needs you to ask other questions as well. Maybe if you want to understand what's going on in his life, it's not just a question of, you know, when you think about your son and you get chest pain, does it radiate into your neck?
Mm.
Maybe it's what's going on with your son, or maybe it's what, you know, maybe it's a way that someone is telling you something important about his life.
Yeah. Inside this patient, I am who I am.
Yeah.
I'm an individual.
And my life is complicated, and all the pieces may not fit together. And I mean, I think the other thing that happens with medical students is sometimes you get this feeling that make the right diagnosis and win a prize. You know, there's the answer, and you'll solve it, and then you'll be the hero. And very occasionally that does happen. I think it happens more often on television. But just this feeling that, you know, there's a right answer, and then there are a lot of wrong answers, and who's going to be the first to get the right answer? And as any of us know who've been sick or who've taken care of, you know, family members who are sick, it usually doesn't work that way.
Yeah. It's a big, wonderful mess.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, all our lives are basically a big, wonderful mess.
Yeah. Dr. Perry Class is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book, Treatment Kind and Fair, Letters to a Young Doctor. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Teaching your students, do you use literature? Novels, short stories, you write them.
I do write them, and I think it's very important for medical students to keep reading, keep listening to music, keep doing things that take them a little bit out of the world of medical school. I have taught medical students using fiction and also using essays about medicine, but I have to tell you that in some ways my strongest prejudice is that they should be reading for pleasure. They should not be dwindling down into people who only do things for their medical school courses, which of course we all do dwindle down a little like that during the training.
Yeah. Is writing something more doctors are doing today, or do you suspect many doctors have always tried to find a little time to write down their thoughts, to reflect on their experiences?
What a good question. It does seem to me that there are more doctors writing, or at least writing for publication, but of course we live in a world in which there are now so many ways. I mean, people can be writing on the internet, people can be blogging. There are sort of more things in the middle. But I think there are more doctors who write, but there have always been quite a few. And I can guess a little at why, because I have thought a lot about the connections between being a writer and being a doctor. And I think that they're both fields which attract busybodies. They're both fields which attract people who like to ask questions and even ask questions which would seem kind of inappropriate in polite conversation. You know, that was what we were just talking about. When you, as a medical student, when you learn how to interview patients and how to take a history, you basically learn how to walk in the room with a stranger and start by saying, "What brings you here today?" And 10 minutes later, you're saying, "Well, let's talk a little bit more about your bowels," or "Let's talk a little more about the various things that you've had on your skin." And that's not normal. That's not polite conversation. And I think the other profession which might understand it best is actually would-be reporters. Hmm. Right? This feeling that it's a thrilling and fascinating thing to have a kind of permission to go beyond polite conversation.
Mm-hmm. The right to be nosy.
Absolutely. And then there's also this appeal, I mean, if you like stories, this is a really good job. If you listen to your patients, there are so many stories out there. They're so unpredictable. They're, you know, you're always sort of, you always find yourself saying, "Boy, I could never have made that one up."
Yeah.
And I think that the impulse from there to feeling, "Boy, I wish I could write that one down," is easy to understand.
Always something to talk about.
Always something to talk about.
And your writing must, you know, we talked a moment ago, you said you advise your students to read for pleasure. I suspect writing is something that has to give you pleasure. And I suspect that you would advise your students to write if it gives them pleasure.
I think it's important, even beyond the pleasure. One of the things which has been missing in medicine, or at least in medical education, has been any kind of opportunity to reflect on what is happening to you. And so much happens to you. If you don't write it down, you forget it. If you don't write down, even just for yourself, notes about the patients who mattered most to you, there all these other patients come. And I sometimes find notes that I've written to myself saying that, you know, "That amazing mother with the three little boys!" Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. And I can't remember her. Clearly, at that moment, I thought I could write a story about her, I could write an essay about her, I could write a book about her. But all these other mothers and children have sort of gotten in the way, and I don't remember what it was that so struck me.
Mm.
I probably remember the diagnosis, if it was a very remarkable medical diagnosis, or the only time I've seen it, or something that I learned a lesson from. But the rest of the story has been, there's been too much other stuff in between.
Yeah. It's a way to hold on to good moments.
I think so.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener. Caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I think you've forgotten another set of professions that gets to ask the questions.
Okay.
And that's social workers, counselors, and therapists.
Very good.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a social worker, and I've always thought that social work is to the social sciences as medicine is to the quote-unquote hard sciences, because you're the practitioner for the researchers. You apply what they've discovered.
I think that's really true, and I think you're right about that pull both toward asking questions and toward telling stories. I think there are a lot of practitioners, and I think that there are a lot of people who find themselves working either in hospitals or in clinics or medical facilities who kind of recognize the shape of a clinical story, and it's one of the ways that they understand each other, because they actually come at it with different training and with different jargons, but you can draw them in around a clinical narrative.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm enjoying the program. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other comments, questions are invited. You can join our discussion this afternoon with a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and 333-WILL. Back to that story of the grandmother in the pediatric intensive care unit watching over her granddaughter. How did the students respond to her? Back to that question. They asked you a couple of questions after this very emotional session. They asked, does it get easier, and is it okay to hug a patient? Great questions.
Great questions.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the beginners or the first-year students ask the best questions. And the answer to does it get easier is yes. I mean, I don't know that that's a noble answer or a sensitive answer, but the truth is, if you stay in this profession, you find ways of living with what you see and ways of protecting yourself. That doesn't mean you don't feel tragedy, you don't cry, and it's also true that for all of us, there are sometimes particular stories or particular patients which affect us so deeply that the level of pain you feel, or the level of sadness, or the level of mourning is very powerful. On the other hand, if you grieved the illness or the death of each of your patients as you would grieve the illness or the death of some, you know, member of your own family, you wouldn't stay in the profession. It would hurt too much. You'd leave. It would destroy you. So you do find ways as you go along of saying to yourself, my job is to remember that I'm here to help this child who is in pain, or this parent who is in such distress, and that's a valuable and valid thing to do. It's not my job to be chief mourner. I think it never gets easy, but it does get a little bit easier as you come to believe in your own role and in your own job, and perhaps even as you grow up and think about, now what would help me at a moment of tragedy or at a moment of terror? How would I want someone to help me through? So I think it does get easier, although never easy. And I think people have a whole range of strategies for dealing with those encounters, those moments, those relationships. And sometimes they're just tragic. Sometimes you know a family, in my field, you know a child very well over a long period of time, and something terrible happens, and it's appropriately terrible, and it feels appropriately terrible. The other question, which was a question I loved, is after that interview, one of the students talking about what happens when you find yourself in a room with someone who's very emotional or who's crying, said to me, is it all right to hug a patient? And I had to think about that, because the answer to that question in that situation was, well, you know, I'm female, I'm the mother of three, it's probably very different for me, you know, I'm almost 50, it's probably very different for me to put my arm around a crying woman a little older than I am than it is for a medical student who is a very, very well-meaning 24-year-old guy to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on his culture, her culture, you know, you have to kind of figure it out as you go along. There's not a hard and fast rule. If you ask, have you ever hugged a patient, my guess would be in pediatrics that almost everyone's going to say, absolutely, and almost no one's going to say, sure, I do it all the time.
Mm.
You know, there are certain, you try to do what's right and what's appropriate, and the hardest thing of all, you try to remember that it's really about the patient's needs.
Yeah.
You try to remember that it's not about you, it's about the patient. And that's a very, very hard thing to remember. It's especially hard when you're just starting out, but it doesn't always come easily, even when you're experienced.
Yeah. I think it's a great question, because being a doctor is so much about touch.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right? It's okay to touch a patient in all kinds of incredibly personal and intimate ways. It's a very good point. But on the other hand, those are kind of professionalized.
Right.
I mean, if somebody starts to cry in your arms, obviously you should pat that person on the back and try to give comfort. But I think what I found myself wanting to say to the medical student is, be a little suspicious of whether it's your impulse to hug the patient or whether you actually think that's what's being asked of you.
We've got a couple of other callers
who
would like to talk with you. Let's go next to a listener in Eureka, line 4. Hi.
Hi. Interesting conversation. I guess I am experience a kind of inner frustration with some doctors, and I think it begins with the jargon that's used. And I guess in my mind, patient almost means passive receptacle of someone who's going to be given something by someone in sort of a superior, inferior way. And I know you're not saying that, but I guess I've experienced enough doctors who say, I'm Dr. So-and-so, how are you? And they sort of come on to you with your first name, which, I mean, that doesn't bother me too much, but it's almost such as I feel that hierarchy. And I appreciate what you're trying to do, because I think you're trying to humanize and really act in a professional way. And I realize one has to be careful about generalizations, but I guess I experienced enough doctors that way that it kind of puts me off.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think you're right. I've experienced doctors that way myself. We consciously try now, and this is not just me, but this is certainly the school where I teach and other schools with which I'm familiar. A lot has changed. When I was a medical student, which is a while ago, but not that long ago, this is in the 1980s, we didn't generally tell people we were medical students. We wore white coats, and people made whatever assumptions they made. Nowadays, we teach the medical students to they wear badges that say they're medical students, mm-hmm. and they're told to come into the room and introduce themselves as medical students, and they are very specifically, for example, told to use titles when speaking to patients. I'm in pediatrics, and with a 6-year-old you don't use you use first name, mm-hmm. but with the parent or with an adult patient, I think you're absolutely right, and I think this is a cultural thing in medicine which I think is changing, but probably more slowly than I think it is.
Mm-hmm. There's probably a demographic to which it is more accurate to use that argument than it is younger doctors. But I guess I really still get put off by it. Yes, I would certainly agree they're authority figures, and they know something. And I think your way seems to be much more of kind of a cooperative relationships, which I think elicits the best in people. But I guess I still get put off, I guess, by the use of authority and power and hierarchy to almost sometimes you feel like you're being treated like a little child, which, you know, again, there's no question of knowledge and competence in a specific area. I don't think that anyone that has any sound mind would question that, but I guess it's the way that that authority and power are used, and I'm glad to hear that there is a more cooperative relationship, because I think that's the key. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener in Terre Haute, Indiana. Line one, hi.
Good afternoon. There are two recent developments in the practice of medicine. I wonder how you deal with them in, with medical students. And those two things are, number one, the fact that pharmaceutical companies are allowed to advertise to the public. And number two, the fact that patients can get online and find out a very great deal about their illness, their illnesses. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, good questions.
Okay, well, I think it's an interesting juxtaposition of questions because they really do address the same thing. That is to say, they bring up the idea of the patient who comes into the room with a certain amount of knowledge and a certain amount of information and maybe even an opinion about what perhaps you might want to, you know, use to treat him with. And clearly that can be very good and that can be very bad. I mean, the obvious thing to say about the internet is people get incredibly useful, helpful information. I still remember taking care of a child with a very obscure diagnosis, the only time I've ever taken care of that child. And when I learned the diagnosis, I looked it up in a textbook and read the three paragraphs in the textbook so I wouldn't feel like a total fool when the parents came back to me with their daughter. And when they came back to me with their daughter, they had a huge folder full of scientific articles that they'd pulled off the internet. And, you know, there's tremendous opportunity for people to find out more about the problems that they have and kind of look at alternative opinions. And then there's a tremendous amount of nonsense. And it's very hard. It's very hard, especially for people without scientific training, I think, sometimes to know, because there are some spectacularly official-looking websites that are purveying opinion, which is really just the opinion of the people making the websites. Mm-hmm. I think it all comes back, though, to what the other caller was saying. It comes back to forming some kind of alliance with your patients and listening to what they say and what they know and considering the possibility. Somebody who's done a good internet search on a particular disease probably knows more about it than I do right at that moment if I didn't know that I was going to be tested on it, right? Somebody who's done an up-to-the-minute internet search of the medical literature on some particular question may perfectly well walk into the room knowing something I don't know, and I need to be willing to listen. I need to be willing to look it up. I need to be willing to acknowledge that I don't know everything in the world, and then I need to be, but I also need a little, I need some respect as well, I guess, in the sense that if I say, look, I've been doing this for a long time, and I've studied this, and I work with this, and this source of information that you used is, shall we say, decidedly outside the mainstream.
Hmm.
And I think one of the problems that doctors sometimes get into with patients is this feeling that it can sometimes go too far the other way in an internet world. All sources of information are equal. Well, doctor, you have your opinion, but I found a website that says just the opposite.
Hmm.
And I think at that point many of us feel that we'd like a little recognition that Not all sources of information are exactly equivalent.
Yeah. I wonder if we'll get better with more time, the more time that we live with the Internet, if we'll get better at being editors.
I think so.
Yeah.
Certainly my children are already far more skillful than I am at navigating, but I tend to think that they also have a better sense than I do for what's reputable and what's not, but we'll see.
The other part of that listener's question, the marketing of drugs today, thoughts there?
Yeah, everything about the marketing of drugs opens so many issues. That is to say, the way the drug companies market to physicians, the way the drug companies market to patients, is very complicated because all of us secretly think that the right way to make the decision about which drug or which drug for what should be totally unaffected by the bells and whistles of advertising or beautiful logos or lovely photos, right? You want your doctor to say, here is what the evidence shows is the best and safest thing with the fewest side effects that is most likely to help you. And there's no reason at all why advertising should have anything to do with that, but there is a lot of evidence to show that the advertising doesn't just influence patients, it influences doctors. And I don't have an easy answer to it because the drugs change all the time. You need new information all the time. And, of course, sometimes in pediatrics, it's not just which is the best and safest and most effective. It's which tastes the best because you can get the kid to swallow it.
Mm.
Speaking as a mother, there's no point in a very effective medicine that the child won't swallow. And there's no point in just telling people, well, you have to make him take it because sometimes you can't.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Is that science or is that marketing making it taste good?
Yeah. We've got to wrap up. There's so many other things we could talk about here this afternoon. One of the things that came through to me really loud and clear in Treatment Kind and Fair is the amount of worrying that goes on. And you come home after a very long day and it's still with you.
Oh, yeah.
Has what worries you changed with the years, and have you learned how to tamp it down?
Every time I think I've learned how to tamp it down, I do something which terrifies me or which I think was really stupid, and it gets much worse. So I may have learned to tamp it down a little bit, but not really successfully. I think that the things I worry about have changed a little over the years, although some of them are still the same. I worry enormously, and I think all pediatricians do, about missing certain things. Looking at a child with fever and missing a meningitis, examining a newborn baby's hips and missing a congenital dislocation of the hip. This sort of thing where there's something you could have made a difference if you'd caught it and you didn't catch it. And this terrible feeling that all of your life to date, all of your training to date, is about that one moment when you face that one thing, and what if you don't recognize it?
Hmm. How long does it take to become a good doctor?
Oh, I don't know. Hmm. It takes so long just to become a doctor, period. but I would say that, I think there are people who are pretty good doctors right out of training because they're smart and they listen and, they have good instincts. But mm-hmm. I think that even those people get better year by year by year.
Yeah. It was interesting to read early in the book, I think it's in the introduction or the preface, the prologue, that one of the reasons that you write is you keep track of what's going on in your life. It's a way to keep track of your own, these are your words, your own changing professional persona. So it's a work in progress.
Well, absolutely, because I think otherwise, I don't know, how can I say it? Otherwise, I would just feel like me. Here I am, I'm me. Well, here I am again today, I'm me again. But when I look back at what I wrote as I was about to be a medical student, as I was a medical student, as I was a resident, as I gradually turned into a pediatrician, I recognize myself, but I also recognize the changes and the evolution and the persona. And I say to myself, boy, here you are when you were a medical student and you were writing about medicine as if you were still kind of, maybe not on the outside looking in, but just being allowed in. And here you are now writing about it, and it's all kind of first person plural. This is how it feels to us.
There, we have to leave it right on time. Dr. Klass, okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you.
My pleasure. Dr. Perry Klass has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's a pediatrician and she's a writer. Her latest book, Treatment, Kind and Fair, Letters to a Young Doctor, the publisher, Basic Books.